the story itself is so vivid. The largest ship in the world, and incidentally the largest thing that man had ever made that could move, loaded with all the most glamorous people of the period. This magnificent ship, loaded with people, proclaimed to be unsinkable, sets out on its maiden voyage across the Atlantic, and the very first time it's out, it sinks, taking many of these prominent people down with her.
It is so much like a Greek tragedy. It's a disaster that could have been so easily averted. But it's also a very human tragedy, that there is the whole gamut of human experience there, from some of the richest people in the world to some of the poorest going off to make a new life in America. And it's very easy for everyone to sympathize and think, what would I do on a ship on a freezing cold April night?
On Wednesday, April 10th, 1912, the luxury liner Titanic began her famous voyage into history. 5 days later, she lay at the bottom of the North Atlantic Ocean. Throughout the century, this most dramatic of all maritime disasters has continued to enthrall historians, artists, explorers, and scientists. We present Titanic, a 20th century parable, produced and presented by Marijke van der Meer.
This 20th century began with the confident belief that human ingenuity could prevail over the natural forces and create a utopia on this earth. It is ending with troubling questions about the moral responsibilities that new technologies bring, and the enormous, almost superhuman powers that have been entrusted to us. Very early on in this century, an event occurred that encapsulates this central dilemma of our age: the sinking of the Titanic on April the 15th, 1912.
On April the 10th, that's 1912, she sailed on her maiden and only voyage for New York. From the moment we left Belfast, we had marvelous weather. I knew only too well that there were chances, if long ones, of sighting an iceberg. But as I reckon, in ample time to clear it with a turn of the wheel.
My mother was absolutely horror-stricken, because the whole world was claiming that that ship was unsinkable. And I so well remember her saying, that is flying in the face of God. And so on the Sunday night, she was reading. I was asleep. My father was asleep. She felt what she described as a very small bump, not enough to waken anyone. And she said she was absolutely certain at that moment what had happened.
It wasn't long before Boxall, the fourth officer, poked his head round my door and said, "Do you know we've struck an iceberg?" Then he said, "The water's up to F-deck in the mailroom." There was no need for him to say anything more. I was into a pair of pants, sweater and bridge coat and out on deck almost as soon as he was. At the same time that Boxall had called me, the order had been given, all hands on deck.
I don't think most people realize the seriousness, but I can't help thinking that once those lifeboats were full, then the people left must have realized the seriousness. And the lifeboats were not properly laden. Only three of them had a light on. There were no biscuits, no water, no blankets. She wasn't going to sink, you see.
Some of the women wouldn't leave their husbands, and we couldn't get them away. But nobody realized then that she would sink, you know. She had a double bottom, but unfortunately, when we hit that berg, it tore her from forehead right off the engine room, and the water simply went straight up into her. Bulkheads couldn't save her ship, because she was torn right out. It's like a knife cutting right through her.
Frankly, I'm never likely to forget the sight of that cold, greenish water creeping step by step up that stairway. I could tell by that staircase measurement exactly what was happening, how far down she'd gone, and how quickly she was going.
She was going down by the head very fast then. I could hear everything. Everything was movable, was crashing through the ship. And in the well where the water was, you could see the water, and the stern was right out. And there were people there struggling and crying, and some jumping overboard.
And so we had the horror of seeing that vast ship gradually sink, which was a terrifying sight. You could hear them all running about and screaming and stamping. Imagine the horror of coming up onto the deck and finding there wasn't a lifeboat for you. All the lifeboats had gone. Of course, you would run from side to side, wouldn't you? I'm sure that's what they were doing. And then the horror of hearing people when they're drowning is worse than anything you can imagine.
The sea was perfectly smooth when we left the ship. Every star in the heavens was visible, but there was no moon. So it was dark. And all the lights were burning, and you could see that she was going down. And we heard all the screams. We couldn't do anything.
She reared up on end, until at last she was absolutely perpendicular. Then, quite quietly, but quicker and quicker, she seemed just to slide away under the surface and disappear. As she vanished, everyone round me on the upturned boat, as though they could hardly believe it, just said, "He's gone."
The lives of over 1,500 people, a cross-section of humanity from many corners of the world, from the rich and famous to the poor, setting out for a new life in America. Gone, too, was the largest movable object made by man, a magnificent feat of modern engineering and interior design. Built in Belfast for the White Star Line, she was a palace of steel and luxury four city blocks long. And gone forever was man's solid and rosy faith in progress through industry and the machine. The trauma of the Titanic disaster announced a new age of anxiety and cynicism. The enormous death toll among the third-class immigrants that night stirred serious doubts about the ability of the upper classes to rule.
Many, many people were kept below in third class, not necessarily to nail them down so they would go down with the ship, but because they didn't want confusion on the boat deck and they wanted to let them up in driblets. The result was that the moving of third class to the top deck was done so slowly that events caught up with them before they could get them done. There were third class barriers which people didn't even get around to opening up.
American historian Walter Lord rekindled interest in the Titanic in the 1950s with his classic account of the disaster, A Night to Remember, which also inspired the famous film. In 1986, he published a fascinating sequel to the book, The Night Lives On, in which he took a closer look at the errors that were made on that fateful passage.
It's not a question that there were such bad policies. It was that there were no policies. It wasn't such poor planning. It was that there was no planning. So that if you were third class, if you had a certain amount of ingenuity, you probably could get to the boat deck all right. But if you were waiting to be told, the way so many travelers are, particularly inexperienced travelers, no instructions would ever come, or nobody would ever look after you. And I think that aspect of lack of planning caused the third-class discrimination that certainly was there that night.
Worldwide indignation at the folly and oversight that destroyed the Titanic revolutionized maritime legislation. Within weeks of her sinking, laws were passed governing all aspects of the safety of life at sea, from compulsory lifeboat drills and around-the-clock operation of wireless sets to ice patrols and passenger ship lanes on the North Atlantic. But as has so often happened in this century, these measures were in response to a tragedy, after the fact. They came too late, for example, for Benjamin Hart, whose 7-year-old daughter Eva saw him for the last time that night.
You see, we'd had no lifeboat drill. That wasn't compulsory in those days, as it is now. And it's in, I'm sure, looking back, having travelled many thousands of miles on the sea since, I'm sure it was quite chaotic. And when I realised the rules and regulations that there are for safety now, and I realised they all came into being because of the Titanic, and I think, well, it took the sacrifice of 1,503 people, my father among them, to make this possible. What a sacrifice to bring in what I would have thought was a piece of legislation that should have existed all along.
It is a familiar 20th century theme. Technology has always advanced faster than our ability to formulate a proper code of conduct for its use. Our ability to exploit the Earth's natural resources on a gigantic scale and to produce weapons of mass destruction have confronted us with unresolved ethical dilemmas. And we still have no moral consensus on such technologies as nuclear energy, genetic engineering, and the information highway. By 1912, shipbuilding technology had advanced so rapidly that even experienced navigators had not been given the time to master the power, the size, and the speed of the vessels in their command. In command of the Titanic's maiden voyage was Captain Edward Smith, a veteran of the White Star Line, and this was to have been his last transatlantic crossing before he retired.
He was the best the White Star Line had, but one problem that had arisen: ships had grown in size so much in the past 20 years that most of Captain Smith's experience was with far smaller vessels. Even 10 years before the Titanic disaster, he was the captain of the Old Majestic, she would have been only 12, 15,000 tons. Suddenly, he was in command of vessels over 40,000 tons. And nobody could instantly pick up all the differences in, let's say, for instance, how long it took to turn a ship of that much greater size. There were no tables or anything worked out that would show the difference between turning a 12,000-ton liner and turning a 45,000-ton liner. There just wasn't the backlog of experience.
As the Titanic inched forward from her berth in Southampton at noon on Wednesday, April the 10th, her tremendous size created such enormous suction that she snapped loose the steel moorings of a nearby ocean liner and sucked the other ship towards her. Captain Smith quickly increased the speed of her portside engine, and a collision was narrowly avoided. The incident seemed to illustrate that no one fully understood the giant new dimension they had entered.
How long did it take her to stop or reverse engines? Nobody really knew. They hadn't had sea trials to test her turning circle and how fast she could stop and reverse. Everything was done in 1 or 2 days, and then she was on her way. It's interesting to me that while the Titanic was on its way from Southampton to Queenstown, she was practicing turns all the way there because they wanted to pick up more experience with handling the ship. Captain Smith had gone from smaller ships to suddenly these great Goliath ships, which nobody had much experience. It wasn't just that he hadn't. Nobody had. The speed with which great new ships were being launched and sailed exceeded the experience of the men who were in charge of them.
In charge on the bridge at the moment the iceberg was sighted on the night of Sunday, April the 14th, was First Officer William Murdoch. Under the pressure of a split-second decision, this experienced seaman made a fatal mistake, for which he paid the ultimate price. An hour and a half before the collision, he had relieved Second Officer Charles Lightoller, who lived to tell the BBC his account of that night.
We were steaming that night at a good 22 knots. At 10 o'clock, I was relieved as officer of the watch by Murdoch, W.M. Murdoch. He and I had been shipmates in many of the ocean greyhounds. And both of us had crossed this ice region times without number, both in clear weather and what's more in fog. Of course, he knew nothing of the death trap lying ahead of us any more than I did.
What did you see?
Iceberg! Get ahead, sir!
Iceberg, get ahead, sir.
Out of starboard!
Out of starboard, sir.
Pull a turn, boat.
Pull a turn, boat, sir.
Close watertight doors.
Close watertight doors, sir.
Out of starboard it is, sir.
His idea was to swing her bow clear and then put the helm hard over the other way and so swing her stern clear. But going at that speed, it was too late. As it was, her bow swung a bit, but not enough, and she struck. She was pierced below the waterline in no less than 6 compartments, and from that moment, nothing could have saved her.
Officers of tankers today don't stop their ship by giving it hard astern, but they just stop it by slowly decreasing the number of revolutions of the propellers. And that might have worked in case of the Titanic, too. Tests later with the sister ship of the Titanic also proved that hard astern was not the best way of stopping the ship.
Edward de Groot is a Dutch maritime historian who has written and co-authored several books on the Titanic. He agrees with those experts who say, in fact, that the best thing First Officer Murdoch could have done that night would have been to fly in the face of traditional logic and drive this huge ship head-on into the iceberg.
So the chance that practically everybody would have survived was if, indeed, Murdoch would have sailed straight on. But Murdoch followed his instinct. He followed how he was trained. You try to avoid a collision, and you don't go head-on into it. But this was a new ship. It was an enormous large ship. People didn't know how to handle these mammoth ships of those times. We have seen it in our own days when the first big oil tankers came, that one after another ran aground or there was trouble or accidents with it. And it's only very, very slowly that people apparently learn how to handle new large objects or to find new systems of how to operate something that is new.
One of the fundamental questions about the Titanic's fate is why she was steaming ahead at full speed through an ice field at night. Part of the answer lies yet again in the misuse of a marvelous new technological breakthrough.
December the 12th, 1901. We're in a haphazard receiving station, rigged up by myself at St. John's, Newfoundland. I was able to receive a succession of 3 clicks corresponding to the 3 dots of the letter S launched by a Morse key on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean.
In the early years of this century, the Italian physicist Guglielmo Marconi made it possible to transmit radio signals across great distances through wireless telegraphy. The Titanic had the most powerful wireless set of any ship at sea. That equipment could have saved the lives of all the people on board that night, but no priorities had been set down for the handling of messages, not even of iceberg warnings. Second Officer Charles Lightoller.
One very vital message received in the Titanic's wireless room that night had never been delivered to the bridge. That message came from a ship called the Mesaba, warning all ships of heavy pack ice, icebergs, and field ice in an area then lying right ahead of the Titanic, and what was still worse, not far away. In my opinion, it was a warning of the most vital importance. Neither he, nor I, nor any other officer of the ship got that message.
there was no real procedure for handling the warnings. Of the six messages that came in on the Sunday that the Titanic hit the iceberg, only one do we really know went to the bridge and was shown to the officers in charge and was noted on the chart. The other five, one of them got to Captain Smith and he gave it to the president of the line, Bruce Ismay, who stuffed it into his pocket. Others, like the message from the Mesaba, we have no idea what happened to it. A message from the America saying there was ice ahead, the Titanic dutifully sent it on to Washington, where it was addressed, but they made no note of it themselves.
The Titanic's two young wireless operators were underpaid crew members, listed with the stewards and pastry chefs in the deck department. They picked up extra tips by transmitting private messages for the fabulously rich passengers in first class. One of the most astounding coincidences of that night occurred at about 11 p.m. on Sunday. Minutes before the iceberg was sighted, the wireless operators had managed to establish contact with Cape Race in Newfoundland, Canada, the nearest point for relaying messages to New York. And the private telegram business was very good, for on board the Titanic, the miracle of wireless telegraphy was not being used as a navigational aid, but as a technical gimmick for the profit and entertainment of wealthy private consumers.
The Titanic had a strong enough signal, it had a long enough aerial to pick up those very weak signals from Newfoundland. There was a ship nearby, it was called the Californian, which could not hear the signals from Cape Race, but could very loudly hear the Titanic. And the operator of the Californian thought it was wise to inform the Titanic that she was stopped in ice. So she started tapping in. All this was in Morse, of course, in Morse signals. Say, old man, we are stopped by ice. To which the operator of the Titanic answered, oh, keep out, keep out. I'm working Cape Race.
What's the matter? What's he say? He says, keep out. Now he's calling Cape Race again. What's he sending to Cape Race? More private stuff. Some big bug wants his private railway car to meet him in New York. How about that? Well, it's time I signed off and got a bit of shut-eye.
He was just that tired. He had started at 7 o'clock that morning, had worked almost all through the day, and 11 o'clock, he had roughed it enough for a Sunday, and he thought he would go off to bed and read a magazine.
The Titanic struck an iceberg minutes later. The Californian was the only ship near enough to have saved everyone on board. But having been told to keep out, her wireless set had been turned off, and for the rest of the night she was deaf to the distress calls of the sinking ship. At 10 past midnight, the Titanic issued one of the first SOS calls in history, and it is only by coincidence that another ship, the Carpathia, received the message 60 miles away, too late to save the 1,500 people stranded on the Titanic's sinking decks.
The operator of the Carpathia had put the earphones down and he had shut down his equipment and he was undressing. And then he realized that there was a new summary from Cape Race, which he wanted to hear. So he put on his earphones again and tuned in to Cape Race. And while he was listening for Cape Race to come in with the news, he heard the Titanic signaling its distress call.
For nearly three quarters of a century, the Titanic eluded those who attempted to locate her wreck. But on September the 1st, 1985, she made front page news once again. A team from the renowned Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts and the prestigious French Deep Sea Research Institute IFREMER pinpointed the Titanic's position. They discovered that she had broken into two sections with her bow and stern pointing north in a debris field 2.5 miles below the surface of the water. Her massive steel plates are covered in rust and her legendary woodwork is gone. In 1986, Dr. Robert Ballard and a team from Woods Hole descended to the site in a manned submersible and became the first people to set eyes on the legendary ship since her disappearance in 1912.
The bow was still majestic. Clearly not something you'd drive away in, but the bow still had its nobility, it still had its beauty. The stern was a carnage of debris, and you felt it when you were there because you knew what final tragedy was played out on that stern section, and the whole appearance of it. It just looked violent, and it looked destructive and torn, and we placed the Titanic memorial plaque right here because we just felt that that was the most appropriate place to place that plaque commemorating the people who perished, because this is where most of the people were, had assembled as the ship sank.
The discovery of the Titanic was a product of the military-industrial complex. The expedition that found her was U.S. Navy financed. The sophisticated side-scan sonar, successfully tested in the search for the Titanic, had military potential, and there was talk of a new race for domination of strategic technologies called Starfish Wars. But the Cold War has ended, and the Titanic has become an object of purely historical and archaeological interest.
The Titanic lies 2.5 miles down, 4,000 meters, and it takes an hour and a half to actually reach the seabed. Then you reach the seabed, they switch on the lights, and there you are in this alien world. My first sight of the Titanic was suddenly out of the gloom. This strange shape appeared that was absolutely massive. It was the propeller of the Titanic. It's just sticking in the seabed, towering way above us, but still in such good condition, you could read the maker's number on it still.
Eric Kentley of the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich has been down to the Titanic on one of the four dives which Ifremer has carried out in recent years for RMS Titanic Incorporated, an organization that wants to retrieve artifacts from the ship.
One of the more interesting finds was a large copper sink that was brought up, which everyone on deck, when it actually came to the surface, thought, so what, a large copper sink? And then the conservator put her hand into it, and she started to bring out fragments of broken plates and knives and forks, and then coins. And that could have been the remnants of the last meal that was served on the Titanic. The washing up bowl, and no one had time to do the washing up before the tragedy struck.
There are some who feel the ship is a gravesite and should remain untouched. But others, like RMS Titanic Incorporated, want to preserve objects retrieved from the Titanic for posterity.
She does remain as a time capsule. We have a piece of 1912 down there, a self-contained unit, which has a huge range of artifacts that can tell us a lot about life in that time. You can see very similar objects elsewhere. You can see bits of White Star porcelain that have come off the Olympic for sale in shops. But there is something magical about the association with the Titanic. It's that association with the greatest maritime story.
Indeed, the National Maritime Museum's exhibition of artifacts from the Titanic drew a record crowd of 700,000 in 1995. There are plans to display all the objects at the Summer Olympic Games in Atlanta and as part of an exhibition that will tour the world before eventually being housed in a permanent museum. As for the Titanic herself, there are no plans to raise her. She rests in a silent, dark North Atlantic grave and in our collective memory as a haunting chapter in the history of 20th century man and the sea.
The Titanic is surrounded by a cloud of bacteria which are eating into the hull to use the iron as an energy source, and this is causing these rusticles. But of course it's also weakening the structure itself. The people on the expedition in 94 noticed that the gymnasium roof had collapsed when it was perfectly intact in 93, and there is speculation that the Titanic could collapse in on itself in perhaps as little as 10 to 15 years.
Titanic, a 20th century parable, was produced and presented by Marijke van der Meer. Technical production by Rick Kingma. This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.